Global Perspectives and Psychedelic Poetics is what it says in the propaganda, which I assume is simply permission to rave about whatever comes to mind. Global Perspectives. I guess what I could say about this, from a psychedelic perspective, the thing that is different for psychedelic people looking at the global dilemma that we're in and that increases, that continues to deepen around us, is that it's, from my point of view, permission to hope rather than despair, because I think that processes, institutions that for 1,000 years or more have been building toward some kind of symmetry break, some kind of definitive self-revealing moment that we now are turning final, as pilots say. We're now deeply embedded in the pattern. We can see enough of what's ahead of us to begin to actually feel the texture of the end of human history. It's no longer an abstraction. Even the straight people who own the world with their long-term and short-term projections, looking at population growth, spread of greenhouse gases, disappearance of the ozone hole, rising third world expectations, so forth and so on. When you propagate all these trends, it seems very clear that business as usual is no longer an option. Nobody's talking about that. So we're either in some kind of final fatal meltdown of the values of Western civilization revealed now after 1,000 or 2,000 year run to essentially be bankrupt, or we're going to transform ourselves unrecognizably. There really isn't any middle ground. The most radical and least likely future of all, it seems to me, is a future in which we continue just to stumble forward as we have been since the Industrial Revolution. That's no longer an option. And so then the question becomes a sort of a Gnostic conundrum. Is this the final act of some kind of great cosmic tragedy in which intelligence rises out of the slime, is shown to be inadequate and sinks back into the slime? Or is this, a tale of difficulty overcome and heroism won? And are we going to be able to shed the monkey nature and shed the ego and actually move up to some kind of shining ideal? You know, if you think of us as the descendants of the angels, this is a pretty tatty circumstance we've come to rest in. On the other hand, if you think of us as the descendants of shit-hurling apes screeching through the treetops, then it's pretty amazing what has been accomplished here. One of the dilemmas that I feel very strongly, and I'm just sort of talking off the top of my head here because whenever a crowd is small enough, I sort of feel like I'm in my own living room. We don't have to have the pretense of knowing lecturer and, eager to be educated audience. The real challenge, I think, is trying to decide what is baggage and what is ballast that's going to have to be dumped. Can the future be a celebration of humanness as we have known it, meaning in the animal body with all its you know, joys and pains with all its frailty and potential for ecstasy? Or is what we call human nature somehow transcendental? And did we only rest for a moment in the monkey body, as once the cutting edge of evolution must have rested in the great reptiles, and at some earlier phase in history rested in the fish, and so on? Is consciousness something uniquely human, and must we keep the animal body with us? Is our destiny to become the gardener caretakers of a revivified earth? Or is the earth like a placenta of some sort, that we have literally sucked all the nutrition and potential out of because we're on our way to some grander, higher domain of being? I don't have the answer to these kinds of questions. I feel it very poignantly. It's very poignantly focused in the psychedelic, in the experience of psychedelic plants and psychedelic shamanism, because, you know, as any of you have followed my ideas on this know, I've spent a lot of time in the Amazon basin with human populations that seem to have struck some kind of dynamic balance with the earth. And yet the paradox of that dynamic balance is that when you take the sacraments, the hallucinogenic plants of these people, you're propelled into worlds of science fiction-like strangeness, transcendental dimensions of titanic implication. And then, at least I personally have come to the realization that this is how those cultures have chosen to deal with the Faustian impulse in human beings. It's been somehow confined in the domain of the imagination. We, meaning we who trace our ancestry back to Europe, are part of a different style, a different strain of human being, if you will. We are the idea excretors, not satisfied to have a canoe, a net, 5 fish hooks, and a bowl, but instead we take matter, we Western civilization, Western technology, and we impress upon matter ideas, millions of ideas, cities like Manhattan, high-performance weaponry, enormous works of art. All of this is a kind of impulse, very strong in Western human beings, to bring the ideas out of the domain of mind and to somehow solidify them in matter. Permanence. The cult of the West is permanence. I always feel that when you can find the obsessive center of a society, you probably have put your finger on its central neurosis as well. I remember when I spent time in India. India is rife with talk of Shakti. Shakti is energy conceived of in various ways. It can be sexual energy, or it can actually be electricity flowing through wires, is called Shakti. And I realized, being in India, that the Indian obsession with Shakti was a consequence of there not being any. That this was a society where energy had become the hardest commodity to encounter. And I think in the West, permanence is the thing, is our great bugaboo, because we are born into the realization that everything is slipping through our fingers at the very moment that it comes into existence. The hardest psychedelic truth to assimilate And you don't have to take psychedelics to assimilate this. If you just live, this will be hammered in on you again and again. And it's not, it's a cause for exaltation. It's a cause for despair. It's that nothing lasts. Nothing lasts. You know, not your fortune, not your misfortune, not your lovers, your enemies, your children, ultimately not even your own life and body. Everything fades. And so the Western response to this is the attempt to create something permanent, civilizations, enduring ideas, enduring institutions. All this is doomed to failure. And I see this Western obsession with the cult of permanence as a consequence of the Western obsession with ego. Ego, to my mind, is the very thing, if you had to somehow meld each problem into the next problem to try and reduce all problems to one, what you would eventually come to is the realization that ego is what is destroying us. Our inability to displace our loyalty away from the unique locus of space and time represented by our own bodies. You know, community, communalism, these are the things that we fear, that we repress, and that we at the same time struggle to realize. I mean, the collapse of communism on one level was the collapse of a repressive, nightmarish, paranoid social system. But the dream which lay behind that was a dream of community, of unity, of sisterhood and brotherhood. And the great concern now is that with the collapse of even a pretense of that position, that we are further fragmented, further atomized into individual competing microbes of greed and need. And this is precisely the attitudes which will push us ever closer to species extinction and to global ruin. Well, when you look at thousands and thousands of psychedelic experiences, to my mind, what you come away with is the notion that, you know, no matter who you are, Amazonian shaman, Hasidic rabbi, nuclear physicist, the psychedelic will dissolve boundaries. It will dissolve your boundaries and force you to realize the commonality of the flesh. You know, it's a startling thing to realize that really what you represent is nothing more than a point of view, and that we each are such a point of view, triangulating perception through what is essentially simply a nexus of our past history. We always are talking about the past and the future, but it's worth noticing that we all managed to get here this morning, this place, this time, and not one of us has the same past as any other of us. This moment, like any moment, is not a confluence of the past. It is a confluence of many pasts. And these many pasts come into a nexus of connection and then move on to become many, many futures. The reason I'm so interested in the psychedelic potential and willing to speak about it is because I think that the myth of our separateness, which was the glory of our institutional accomplishments, parliamentary democracy, individual rights, liberation of various classes and so forth, has now turned somewhat sour. There has got to be something more to it than just turning people loose to loot the planet so that everyone can pile up more and more stuff. Stuff which doesn't satisfy anyway. And I think in talking about the future, what we have to somehow do is dematerialize the future. And there are several ways, or many ways, to do this. People have preached voluntary simplicity, and some people are into this. However, it's hypocritical to preach this in the third world to people who have nothing. You know, we have everything, so we've seen the fallacy of condominiums and Mercedes, so then we preach this in Bangladesh. This is a bit disingenuous. The dematerializing of culture. Somehow, you see, what we have to recognize in the wake of the collapse of communism is that capitalism as well is a system with a fatal flaw that is set against human nature. Capitalism assumes an endlessly exploitable frontier of resources. This we have got not. So capitalism is now essentially, unless it can be radically retooled, an anti-human philosophy. It's literally chewing up the ground we're standing on. But there is nothing in the basic notion of capitalism that says that we have to be thing dealers. This is simply the style of capitalism that we have fallen into. Somehow, we have to dematerialize existence. And I don't know whether that means virtual reality. Some of you have heard me say that my vision of a perfect future is, you know, 25% of the present world population living in ecological balance, living in an apparently primitive, naked, aboriginal state. But when you step into the minds of those people and look behind their closed eyelids, there are menus hanging in bio-tele-electronic space. Culture, you see, can be downloaded into a chip, installed behind the eyelids, so that it is, you know, freely commandable as an experience in the imagination. But if we insist on continually extracting resources from the earth and fashioning our dreams out of the stuff of earth, then our dreams are destined to turn to nightmare. It can't be any other way. So that's one thing about the future. The future needs to be dematerialized. And then, you know, since people always accuse me of being a harebrained dreamer, I've tried to come up with something approaching a practical suggestion, and I took this need to the feet of the mushroom gods. Having been challenged by somebody at a talk like this, they said, well, you're always saying these mushrooms speak. Why don't you ask them how to save the world? And I thought this was kind of disingenuous, but the next time I had the telephone to hyperspace in my hot hand, I did make the inquiry. And the suggestion which came back, I think, is at least food for thought. The suggestion was, you want to save the world? You want to overcome male dominance, the momentum of consumerism, so forth and so on. Every woman should bear only one natural child. This is an interesting idea, whether you take it seriously as program or not. If every woman were to commit herself to bearing only one natural child, the population of the earth would fall by 50% in 40 years without war or famine or epidemic disease. If this program were continued for another 40 years, the population would fall by half again. This means in 80 years, the population of the planet could be reduced 75%. Why have we not heard anything about this, even for it to be denounced? I'm not saying it has to be embraced, but why isn't it a tiny fanatical minority advocating this? I think it's because it's inconceivable in this society to try and practice capitalism in a situation of retreating demographics. It also would be a solution which would place enormous power in the hands of women. Women are often heard to complain about their powerlessness. Yet here's a plan which requires very little input from white guys. I took this idea to demographers and said, what about it? This seems so simple. Most people think there are no solutions. Here's a very simple solution. What about it? And they said, yes, well, it's more startling than you realize, because women in upper class, high tech, Western society, a woman, say, on the Upper East Side of Manhattan or Malibu or the Seacliff District of San Francisco, a child born to that woman will have 800 to 1,000 times more negative impact on the earth than a child born to a woman in Bangladesh. If you were to go to Bangladesh and meet a woman in the back streets of Dhaka who told you that her ambition in life was to have 900 children, you'd think you were dealing with some kind of sociopath, a kind of typhoid Mary of the demographic scene. And yet, every child born into moderately well-off yuppie families in high-tech societies is in that position. We prefer not to think of it this way. I think it's very interesting that one could make a case to women in Western societies. You could say, how would you like vastly increased leisure time? How would you like increased disposable income? And how would you like to take upon yourself a truly heroic social role? This is what's being offered with this suggestion to limit reproduction to one natural child. No more heroic, no more politically correct action can be taken. And interestingly, the women you want to convince of this position are the women you are most likely to be able to convince. Educated, white, women with above average incomes. So that's a very practical suggestion, more likely to be implemented than my dream of lunar inoculations with psilocybin for the entire population to dissolve the calcareous ego formations that have sprung up in the bloodstream since the last full moon, which I also think would be a fine idea. You see, boundary dissolution is what is needed here. Boundary dissolution of all type. Our separateness is an illusion. There is a kind of human bedrock. That's why I think that the world sweep toward democracy is far more than simply a political trend. Democracy is not exactly a style of government per se, or exclusively. Democracy is something, is a biological institution of some sort, because there is no theory, there is no abstraction, there is no ideology. I mean, democracy is as close as you can get to anarchy and still have any theory of organization at all. You know, I wrote a book which is around and about called The Archaic Revival. And that's why my belief in the Archaic Revival is what brings me out to events like this. I mean, I think the term New Age and some of these other terms are pretty trivializing and basically designed by the mavens of marketing to draw you in. But there is an impulse throughout the 20th century. in Freudianism, in abstract expressionism, in Dada, psychotherapy, sexual permissiveness, psychedelic experimentation, jazz, rock and roll. These are all facets of an impulse toward the archaic, toward the primitive, the non-straight, the anti-bow tie, the wish to blow up the staid world created by the fine ladies and gentlemen of the 19th century with their Christer ethics and their long dresses and all of that business. There is an impulse toward the archaic. This is very healthy. This is what happens when a society seeks to revivify itself. When the medieval world exploded in the face of the Italian city-states and the new classes that were emerging, they reinvented classicism. It was actually the second time classicism had been rediscovered. It was also trotted out by the Arabs in the 9th century when they needed a stabilizing metaphor for the Umayyad Caliphate and those civilizations. Now, in the 20th century, we can't go back to ancient Greece and Rome or Babylon. And in a sense, the New Age, I think, is an effort to go back to a kind of Minoan/Egyptian world, which never existed except perhaps in the minds of certain menopausal theosophists. But the impulse is laudable, however screwy the results. But I think we have to reach further back, that all of history is what our urtext, the Bible, tells us it is. It's a confusion, a kind of punishment, a wandering in the wilderness, and that where we really want to be is naked, singing in the rainforest, stoned and exalted, one with the souls of the ancestors, one with the Gaian spirit of the planet. And I don't mean to imply that psychedelics simply act negatively, dissolving ego, dissolving social constructs, dissolving programming and neurosis. That's all true. But what is left when all this dissolving has taken place is not simply a tabula rasa, a clean slate. What is left is what we forgot, what we have been so long away from, which is a connection into the reality of the Gaian mind. The great news that all shamanism can attest to and is built on is the news that there is a sentient, minded, caring entity that surrounds and holds the planet in its hands, in its heart, and beyond comprehending. I mean, call it Gaia, call it God, call it the spirit of nature. It doesn't matter what you call it. It transcends the rational apprehension of higher primates. And yet it is there. We know that our own peculiar form of self-reflection emerged in just a couple of million years out of animal organization. Well, what we don't know is how many other forms of mind there are possible, and how many times in the 2 billion year history of life on this planet intelligence has been able to shed the dark chrysalis of matter and launch itself into nearby dimensions in which it finds completion and happiness. And I think that this is the great news that informs the shamanic religions, that we are not alone, and that the other that we can make our way toward is not, a galactarian intelligence from Beta Reticuli that is part machine symbiote, part banana slug, or something like that. That the coherent-minded entity that we make our way toward is actually a reflection of what is best in our hearts, that we carry in ourselves the seed of this thing, and that we are like the guy in the story of the prodigal son. We have fallen into history. And out of this misfortune, out of this experience, we can make gold if we return to the fold of the ancestors. If we can somehow take what we've learned from history and fold it back into the experience of being truly human. And this is the challenge. And it faces us on the political level, issues such as, you know, all kinds of community issues such as racism and sexism and classism. These are community issues. And then issues between the human community and the planet. Our inability, you see, to emotionally connect with the consequences of what we're doing. I mean, we as a species present a perfect picture of pathology, because what real psychotic behavior is behavior that one cannot emotionally connect with the consequences of what is being done. And when you realize that we are literally looting the cradle of future human life, that we have decided that we are not simply transient occupiers of this domain, but that it is ours to trash, to use up, to do with as we wish, leaving nothing for the future, then you realize the depth of our need for immediate and widespread therapeutic, indeed pharmacological, intervention on our state of mind, because we have wandered from anything like real human values. And the reason psychedelics are so threatening in this society is because they immediately throw into high relief the internal contradictions of the dominator's style of doing business. And this is what must happen. The momentum toward catastrophe, built up over centuries, is immense. The only antidote to that that I have seen, extrapolating from what I've seen it do to single individuals, are the shamanic hallucinogens. Because when you cut right to the bone, what has to happen is we must change our minds. If we don't change our minds, we're going to go down with this self-generated Titanic called Western civilization. And we have the power to change our minds, but it won't come from hortatory preaching. If that would work, then we would have turned the bend at the Sermon on the Mount. But as it is, I think we turned the bend sometime in the 20th century, either when Albert Hofmann invented LSD, or Gordon Wasson found the mushrooms of Oaxaca, or Richard Schultes brought back news of ayahuasca from the Amazon basin. You see, we have to humble ourselves. We have to give up the Titanic, ego-driven idea that we can do it by ourselves, as religions and yogins and all that beady-eyed crowd are into promising. The first step on the path of real self-transformation is the admission that you must humble yourself so thoroughly that you need to form a pact with an organism that begins its life in a mound of manure. You know, it's a true alchemical journey. You return to the dross. And out of that which everyone has rejected, literally the compost of being, you find the jewel. And the jewel can be grown, cultivated, brought to fruition, internalized, globalized, shared to create a transforming option that does honor to a human experiment that has been going on far too many millennia for us to fumble the golden opportunity away. Is there anybody who's burning with their own agenda that, oh, here's a burning person, yes.
I had an experience about 3 years ago now, maybe 4 years ago, where I was on a hallucinogenic, and I had a feeling that I was talking to some people, and they were telling me that when we leave this planet, we become stars. And I was just wondering, what have you got anything more on the outer space connection?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, it's funny for me to be talking at a place like this, because I am actually a rationalist. It's simply that my experience has been very, very peculiar, and I thank God for it, because I think most rationalists actually live lives which reinforce their rationalism, maybe because they don't poke around enough in the edges of things. I mean, you know, we have orthodox ideology, I don't know what it is now, free markets, democracy, and physics or something, and then you press out a little bit to the fringes and you discover that reality is not only not as you supposed it to be, but it's not like anybody supposed it to be. The maps we have are largely based on conjecture and naive hope. The hope that there's nobody hiding in the woods, the hope that there's nobody waiting behind the hill. When I first started taking psychedelics, it all ran pretty much according to Hoyle. LSD, it seemed like a tremendous tool for insight into the structure of the personality, kind of high-powered, turbocharged, self-directed psychotherapy, you know, which is certainly useful, illuminating, but doesn't violate the laws of physics or threaten the foundations of Western science and philosophy. What has interested me and become the focus of my personal life, I guess, are these tryptamine hallucinogens, DMT, psilocybin, and then ayahuasca, which is simply a strategy for making DMT orally active. And, you know, one could accept, I think, insights into one's upbringing, insights into the structure of philosophy or mathematics or something like that. But what is hard to accept are, you called them gibberish people. I call them self-transforming elf machines or tykes or fairies. And to my mind, this is confounding. This is no mere extension of the models of the psyche that we inherit from Freud and Jung. It begins to look as though that, you know, the mind is not even in the brain. There's some kind of extended landscape of possibility. And I speak as somebody who's been there, who's seen this stuff, but who doesn't, I don't have an agenda. In a sense, I'm sort of chicken shit, because the motivation for my public career is to get a whole bunch of people to march with me in there, to check again, because, you know, well, I talk in the book I wrote for Bantam, Food of the Gods, about DMT, because I think it's, in a sense, the case where all the issues are most intensely brought together. It's a naturally occurring neurotransmitter, endogenous in the human brain. It also is very fast acting. It clears your system very quickly. Not only clears your system, but leaves no trace whatsoever. You can't even feel that you have done some kind of substance a half hour after you do this stuff. Nevertheless, the content of the experience itself is absolutely paradigm challenging. And the chief reason is because there are these entities in there. And on psilocybin, you hear them. They speak to you. What you were describing, it's almost as though this is some kind of a mandala of pharmacological approaches to the mystery, and DMT lands you right in the center of the bullseye. I mean, 30 seconds after smoking DMT, you confront these things which look like, I mean, it's very hard to force language into these dimensions and then bring it back. But what they look like to me is self-transforming, self-dribbling basketballs or something. I mean, they come bounding forward. When you enter into the space, there's a kind of a cheer, you know, hooray, and suddenly you're there. And this is not the cumulative effect of spirulina or hanging out at Findhorn or imbibing any of these ideologies which permit this kind of thing. I mean, I come out of, Jean Genet and existentialism and Sartre. I'm very much more mainstream, down, dreary Western approach. These things do not require belief to sustain their existence. You may doubt, you may deny, and yet there they are. And it's not some kind of neutral panorama like window shopping. It's an encounter. It's a situation in which you see them, they see you, and the relationship between you and them is very rapidly evolving. They seem to have been waiting. And the impression I get is, well, it's not an impression I get, it's what they say. They say, here you are again, how wonderful. It's not exactly in English, you understand. And they have, they're not made of matter. The question is, you know, what is the ontos of these things? What is their exact ontological status? And as far as I can tell, they're made of language. They are not composed of DNA, sinew, tissue, and blood. They're composed of syntax. They are like self-articulating sentences or language that has no requirement for a speaker. It is its own self-generating system of meaning. And in, you know, the immediate impression you have is, if you're a sane person, is, you know, my God, what is this? And then, is it okay? Am I, number one, am I still alive? And you check through, you know, take a quick inventory. Breathing, normal. Blood pressure, normal. Heart, normal. But what you're seeing is a complete replacement of the ordinary world. And these things, which are not enough like elves, gnomes, and fairies. It's almost as though, you know, you would look to folklore to provide evidence for the existence of these things, but the elves, gnomes, and fairies of folklore are a little too predictable, a little too humanoid, a little too Disney-esque for what you're dealing with. These things actually appear to be as alien a form of life as it would be possible for a human being to imagine and still cognize that it's alien intelligence at all. And they are performing an extraordinary activity in that place, which is they possess a language that can be seen with the eyes. And this is fascinating to me. I really think that there's something to be learned here. This is what they want you to learn. They come forward, they utter statements, which, remember, you don't hear with your ear, but which you see as condensed sculptural objects, which are like Fabergé eggs or beautifully tooled machines of glass, shell, and crystal, except these things are in motion. They're opening up in front of you, and they're pressing in. There's a kind of frantic intensity to this kind of an encounter. It's like a Bugs Bunny cartoon running backwards at twice normal speed. I mean, stuff is just flying all over. And they're saying, don't abandon yourself to amazement. Don't just go gaga with disbelief. Try and focus on what we're doing. And then if you are able, even moderately, to focus on what they're doing is they're offering you these objects. And they're saying, look at this, look at this.